Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with Tom Gilson. Tom is the National Field Director for Ratio Christi, responsible for training and supporting their regional and chapter directors. Tom was on staff with CRU, or Campus Crusade for Christ, for over 30 years and has wide-ranging experience as a ministry strategist, writer, teacher, HR leader, blogger, and apologist. The purpose of this interview is to catch up with Tom about his current work with Ratio Christi, the publication of the book True Reason, and to chat about his argument for the historicity of the Gospels. Well, thanks for joining me for the interview, Tom.
Well, thank you, too, Brian. And I have to say that you have got a very highly spoken of website with some very incredible apologists on it, but I have a claim to fame that very few of them have. And that is that I am maybe the luckiest apologist among them, except for there may be a few others, because I got to have lunch with you a while ago in Michigan, and what a treat that was. It's good to talk with you again here now, though.
Yeah, I'm glad we could meet up, and glad to have you back. And we spoke originally on the podcast a few years back when you were on staff with Crew, but you've transitioned to a new role at Ratio Christi now, and you told me how that was going. It was back in July. A lot of exciting stuff, and so I'm glad to have you back. First off, though, why'd you make the move, Tom?
Why did I make the move? Well, I had 34 years of ministry with Campus Crusade. Actually, I had 33 years of ministry with Campus Crusade for Christ and one with Crew, because that's about the time the organization changed its name. And it is still, in my opinion, and I will always regard it as one of the very best things that God is doing, has done, and will continue to do in his work to reach people for Christ around the world. But over the last few years, he gave me the opportunity to get to know the leaders of Ratio Christi back when it was very small, and it was just our president, Rick Schenker, and Blake Anderson, the number two guy, who is now my boss. And I grew to really appreciate what they were doing, their heart, their capability, their capacity for getting a lot done. And I was talking with them on the phone last March, I think it was, just over a year ago. And I had done some consulting for them a couple of years earlier on organization and structure. And well, we were talking about things, and they said that in the 2 years since then, they had grown from 10 campuses to 100. And I thought, how in the world are you leading this? You're high capacity, but nobody's that high capacity. And said, it sounds like you need a national field director. And that's what I ended up doing, was transitioning to that. And I did it partly because Ratio Christi is an organization that was growing really fast, has incredible potential to change the world. And there is, to me, there was a sense that somebody had to come along and help make it happen. Because what a tragedy if that potential fell short. But it's an organization that's on now in various stages of development, more college campuses even yet, 130 or 140. And we can hardly keep up with the requests for growth. What we're doing is we're trying to help college students know the reasons for faith, for confidence in the faith of Jesus Christ. And I just love being a part of that. It's a long answer to a short question, but that's, I'm leaving out a lot too, to a short version of a longer answer.
Yeah. Well, I've seen its growth in the past year or so, so much, and it's exciting what's happening. But for those who are just finding out about Ratio Christi, they might be thinking, well, what is that? Is it Campus Crusade for Christ? Is it a club? You know, student groups?
Right.
How does that work? So just explain what a Ratio Christi chapter is, where they can be found, and what happens at them.
Sure. We have in our college ministry, which is still the main part of what we're doing, we have, as I said, 130, 140 chapters in college campuses, predominantly in the United States, although we're growing internationally. And these chapters are led by people who are qualified apologists. They've got certificates or degrees or some other kind of demonstrated competence in knowing the reasons for confidence in the faith. They meet once every week or two. Typically 10 to 20 students is a good number for us, because we're not trying to be a Campus Crusade for Christ or a CRU or an InterVarsity or Chi Alpha or NAVS or any of these other ministries. We're more of a specialty ministry. We could, and we're there for students who have a real heart to ask questions or to understand answers about the hard questions about the truth and the implications of Christianity. With respect to the other organizations, we are trying in every way we can to connect with them and serve as a, as maybe you could call us a technical resource in a way, to help them with, again, some of those more technical questions, but just to be alongside as friends and as prayer partners and as co-ministers as well. Also on a college campus, typically every year, maybe twice a year, we'll bring in a major campus-wide event, a speaker, a debate, or something like that, where we can try to expose students to the reasons for the truth of Christ, and where we can work together with other campus ministries to help build up what they're doing as well.
Yeah. Well, since you've joined, Tom, and now you're the national field director there, talk about what work you're doing and how you've seen things grow in the past year or so, and what you're actively involved in there.
One of the things that I've seen grow is Ratio Christi College Prep, which is actually not under my area of responsibility, but Michael Sherrard leads it. And it's ministry to youth by way of youth leaders and parents, training leaders and parents in how to instruct and encourage and train youth in reasons for the faith. That could be growing a lot faster, but the same thing is true for the same reason with our college ministry. What I am working on most right now is the same thing that Michael is concerned with, in a different sense probably, though, with Ratio Christi College Prep. And that is that we have the ability, based on the interest out there, to grow at an incredible exponential rate. But we need to have an infrastructure build up. This is my chance to put out a plea, I guess, for people who have a leadership experience in some facility with apologetics, at least, to help us build a regional leadership structure. That's what I've been working on the most, is finding and developing regional leadership for our ministry. The campus ministries are led by people who know their apologetics, but have not always had training in ministry or in leadership skills, and they just need encouragement, because it's a contentious environment there when you're talking about apologetics on campus, and it's a place where people need encouragement. So that's been my main focus of growth, is building up a regional leadership structure.
Well, excellent. Well, I know that chapters like these, and when groups of like-minded Christians can come together and talk about reasons for faith, how to defend their faith, how to respond to the tough questions and challenges they're getting in university-type environments, I mean, it's so encouraging, and to have that sort of support network. And so I love that people can find that through Ratio Christi. Now, how can people find a chapter near them? And if somebody wants to get involved with it, whether it's in some sort of a leadership role or just in being part of it, how can they find that? Who can they contact, and what do they need to do?
The number one answer to all those questions is to come to our website. By the way, Ratio, that's the Americanized pronunciation of Ratio, which is reason. The name stands for the reason of Christ. Our website is ratiochristi.org, ratiochristi.org. And there you can find links to chapters that are in existence. You can find links to places to ask questions about starting a new chapter, and people who are potentially interested in helping us lead this movement can also find links to contact us, all there at ratiochristi.org.
Well, great. Well, definitely point people to that. They can go to today's blog post as well for other links that we'll include for finding out about Ratio Christi. And I want to shift gears a bit here, Tom, because you're active in a lot of different veins along the lines of apologetics. And one thing I wanted to ask you about is the book True Reason. Now, maybe some listeners or visitors to the website and podcast have found links to, you know, an online Kindle version of this book, True Reason, but now it's been published in print. So tell our listeners a bit about this book.
This was a fun project. It started 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, maybe, in December of 2011, when I was actually being kept awake by thoughts of an upcoming Reason rally, as they were calling it, that leading atheists were going to be holding in March of 2012 in Washington, D.C., on the Mall at the base of the Washington Monument. And I had been involved online through my blog, thinkingchristian.net, and I had been involved with atheists there in a lot of debate. And I've read, at that point, had read plenty of atheist books, and I knew that they liked to call themselves in one way or another the reason people, the party of reason, and this was the reason rally they were going to hold. And I kept, I was laying awake that morning thinking, why are we letting them get away with this when reason really isn't their strong point? Somebody ought to write a book, but it's only 3 months away and there's no way. And then I realized that I had friends who could write and that we could put an ebook together in a certain amount of time. And by God's grace, we had this ebook that you already mentioned available for sale on Kindle and in 77 days after that. And God opened up doors for us to be able to stand for Christian reason, for true reason. In the press, we went to the Reason Rally. I was there along with Ratio Christi people there, including Blake Anderson and other Ratio Christi leaders and students before I was involved with Ratio Christi. And it was an opportunity to take a stand for Christ. But people were asking, can we get the book in print? And the answer was, we're trying to do that. We're trying to do that. Until finally, late in February, early in March, we were able to release the book that Craigle Publications published for us, that was a revised version of the book True Reason. And the point of the book is this, that just as I said, the atheists make a claim to being the party of reason, but they don't do it that well. And Christianity, on the other hand, has a strong claim to be reasonable and based in reason. And so we have a two-part approach to the book, which is dealing with atheist claims and then dealing with Christian claims to reason.
Well, you mentioned a number of the various contributors. Would you mind just mentioning a few? And then I'm curious about how the book was received initially.
Well, William Lane Craig and Sean McDowell were the headline contributors of the first version, along with, now I'm not going to get them all, I'm afraid, Carson Weidenauer was the most important co-contributor. He is now, by the way, the U.S. Director of Ravi Zacharias Ministries, and he was co-editor with me. But along with that, John DePoe, David Wood, David Marshall, Chuck Edwards, Samuel Youngs, I hesitate to go down the list, but every one of them was a really important contributor with us. In the second edition, Timothy McGrew also joined in with us in making the book happen and expanding and making a revised version of it. We got criticism from atheists who objected, as you might expect, to the position we were taking in it. But here's the point that we were trying to make with it. And by the way, Christian response was very strong, and we were really pleased with that. But here's the question with reasonability. As I have looked at atheists, with very few exceptions, as I've looked at what atheists say about reasonability, what they say is that in order to be considered a reasonable person, you need to be someone who makes your decisions about knowledge based on what you can see, or hear or taste or touch. And you need to make all of your decisions empirically. And you need to conclude that there is no God. That's a reasonable person, according to the atheist. Well, that's really not a reasonable approach in itself, because what it's saying is that we're defining reason according to the conclusions you come to. Now, that doesn't work, because suppose you came to the conclusion that the earth was round and you called that a reasonable conclusion. Well, that might be a right conclusion, but if you concluded it on the basis of the fact that basketballs are round and I like basketballs and therefore the earth is round, that's not reason. You can have a right conclusion and get to it by wrong processes. And if you call yourself reasonable for reaching the right conclusion, that's a false view of reason. Well, that's what the atheists do, except I don't think they come to the right conclusion either. In the atheist literature, we almost never hear them say that reason means being able to go from evidences taken from an unbiased perspective and going through proper channels of reasoning to a sound conclusion. You almost never hear them talking about that. That's what our book focused on to start with. And then we showed how they don't do that very consistently. Sounds pretty technical, by the way, and that part of the book really isn't. We just show that in a lot of ways they're not as reasonable as they claim to be.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that it's finally in print as well, and I'm hoping that it has even a greater impact in print. And it does remind me, you're talking there about how many atheists take a position of reason based upon how one comes to knowledge or how one draws their conclusions, and many times that's influenced as well by naturalistic presuppositions. And it reminds mm-hmm. reminds me of some of the interactions you've had recently with the book by atheist professor Peter Boghossian, and he wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists, sort of like a tactical guide for the skeptic to go out there and try to dissuade believers from coming to such silly conclusions in a mm-hmm. kind and generous way, supposedly.
Yeah.
But talk a bit about your interactions with that book, with the author and his so-called street epistemologists.
Well, my biggest regret about the book True Reason is that we didn't get a chapter in it about Peter Boghossian, because he is a professor at Portland State University in Oregon. He teaches critical thinking there, and he claims that even though he's published a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists, he claims that he's more interested in developing the ability to think well than he is interested in creating atheists. And he just assumes that if you think well, that you will decide that atheism is true. Well, the problem with that is that Peter Boghossian is one of the clearest examples of someone who does not think well. And I say that advisedly. It's a strong statement to make, but he has made in public lectures and in his book, there is one identifiable logical fallacy following upon the heels of the next, following one after another. And he is not an example of good critical thinking. So I did a series of blog posts in Unthinking Christian that I ended up compiling into an ebook that I called Peter Boghossian, Atheist Tactician, identifying just a few of these logical fallacies. And he never wanted to respond to me directly. There was another blogger named James Lindsay who has co-written some articles with him, who I think was acting more or less as his proxy, who took me to task for many things. One of the things that Boghossian says is that faith is either knowing, pretending to know things we do not know, or else believing without evidence. And that's definitional of faith. He says that it is definitive of faith, that it is belief without evidence. And I said in my blog post, that cannot be true as the definition of faith, because if that were the definition of faith, then Jesus Christ himself would have been one of the greatest campaigners against faith in all history. And this is why. If faith is belief without evidence, Jesus presented himself alive with many evidences, it says in the beginning of Acts 1. He provided evidences for his deity all through his ministry. He was an evidence giver. And if faith is belief without evidence, he was taking away people's opportunity to have faith. Well, the definition of faith in American, well, in world culture is predominantly influenced by the Bible. What James Lindsay said was, you can't use the Bible. Here you are going back to the Bible. You're trying to persuade us atheists by using the Bible. We don't believe the Bible. And how can you think that we should trust the Bible? And I'm saying, no. At this point, we're just talking about what the word means. And the word's definition has come to us down through the Bible, primarily. And Boghossian, I think from tweets that he was doing, was sitting on the sidelines and occasionally commenting on this conversation. And we never came to a resolution with me and James Lindsay. But this is typical that Boghossian, you know, through and Lindsay on his side too, would be talking about faith as if they could just change the definition. And that we're all supposed to accept it, regardless of what the evidence of history is.
Well, it seems to me that so much of the argument hinges and is got the foundation of the whole element of how they're defining faith as sort of an epistemology. It's simply wrong to say that faith is an epistemology. But everything right. seems, in from what I've read, to be based upon that definition. And as soon as you criticize that, so many other elements of the argument fall apart because Christians don't believe that.
Distorting a definition, and he's making it, he's trying to undermine a belief that we don't hold. That's really what's going on in so much of what he's doing. What's going on in my mind as we talk about this too, by the way, Brian, is that there is so much to talk about. And that was true for the book True Reason. It's true for even Ratio Christi, that I'm having a sense that I'm trying to explain everything when I don't have time to explain more than a mere fraction of a percentage of anything. I'm hoping that people will take a look at these, at the book, at ratiochristi.org, and check out for themselves some of the what I'm stumbling over myself trying to express in a few words.
Well, I'll definitely point people back to some of your work there with Peter Boghossian's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, because it came on the scene in a very evangelistic sort of way. And what you've been talking about in this interview is a part of a larger context of the discussion that has been started because of Peter Boghossian's work. So I think people mm-hmm. need to be aware of it because he's sort of created a community online of people who their goal is to try to deconvert Christians in a tactical way using critical thinking and the Socratic method and that sort of thing. So I'll point our listeners back over to thinkingchristian.net and link to some of these articles and some of the interactions so if people want to find out more, they can. You've been doing a little bit more writing there on the side, and some of it was recently published through Touchstone Magazine. Give us a little bit of background of this article we'll discuss.
Okay, this is something that's been a really exciting thing for me to explore. It's an argument in favor of the historicity of the gospel accounts, and it's specifically answering the charge that they are legends. And in this article, I put it in context of the atheists who say that C.S. Lewis missed a point when he said it was Jesus a liar or a lunatic, or was he the Lord? They say, well, none of those. He was a legend. When Lewis wrote that argument, it was in Mere Christianity. It was really just a biblically based argument that required no particular technical knowledge. And somehow it occurred to me that the legend question could be answered in the same way, without any particular amount of technical knowledge, just by looking at Jesus Christ and his character as it's expressed in the Gospels. He is too good to be false. And that's the point of the article. But it does take a little bit of background knowledge. It takes knowing how the skeptics and the atheists conceive of the legend of Jesus Christ arising. That basically Jesus was probably a real person and had real followers who were disappointed, deathly disappointed by his death and by his failure to become the Messiah that they had hoped that he was and would be. And in order to resolve their cognitive dissonance and in order to keep growing, and they developed a legendary view of him that included him being a miracle worker and rising from the dead. And Bart Ehrman says that this required, for example, something like the game of telephone, where it was one person, you know, in the traditional birthday party game, it's whispering into the ear of another. But the essence of it is that as it goes around the circle, there's no real error correction. Well, Ehrman says that this actually took place in multiple cultures, multiple languages, all around the Mediterranean basin, if not more, and that through that method, the whole story got distorted. That's the legend theory in a nutshell. But look what it produced. Jesus Christ is unique among all characters in history and in literature. And by literature, I mean all literature, including the great classics and including mythology and including comic books and TV shows and movies. He is unique among all characters in this sense. There is no one else in all of history or imagination who has had incredible power approaching Jesus Christ, power, and at the same time used that power only to serve others. Jesus Christ stands out among, if he was a fictional character, he would stand out head and shoulders, miles above all other fictional characters, for the quality of his character as the self-sacrificial person who could have done everything for himself and never did. If I got $1 million and I gave it all away, I would probably buy myself a good meal first. Jesus had more power than $1 million worth of power, and he used it only for others. Now tie that back to the legend theory. Nobody else in all of literary history has come up with a character quite like Jesus. But the skeptics want us to believe that four different authors gathered that story up from a community, a non-community of people spread out over all over the Mediterranean, who developed a story through a distorting game of telephone. And by the way, this wasn't a community of faith, as the legend theorists all often put it, because the legend theorists usually think of faith as being a community, as being in cognitive dysfunction. So what we had is a non-community of cognitive dysfunction coming up with the most perfect character ethically in all of literary history. And I'm thinking, how likely is that? He's too good to be false.
Well, I like this argument, Tom, because it resonates with me, and I, of course, I think it's true. but I can imagine some skeptics responding to it saying, well, just because a story is great doesn't make it true. I'm wondering what your response is to that possible vulnerability to the argument.
Sure. Yeah, communities can develop good stories. I grew up in Michigan, where we really enjoyed the story of Paul Bunyan. And there are great stories out there, and I'm a great fan of Dostoevsky as one of the great art authors, and of Shakespeare, and I wish I could say I read more of them than I do, but there are great stories out there. But this one The difference in this one is that what it specifically addresses is the possibility, or the proposal rather, that the story of Jesus arose by these particular legendary processes of what they call a community of faith, but I think what they really mean is a non-community of cognitive dysfunction. And what I'm trying to propose with my answer is that that's an unlikely source for a character of the sort of character that Jesus is. Somewhere along the way, someone distorted the story of Jesus. Somewhere along the way, if the skeptics are right, somewhere along the way, someone lied. Somewhere along the way, someone who could have made a correction and said, wait, no, he didn't rise from the dead. This isn't true. Somewhere along the way, that didn't happen. Somewhere along the way, distortions and falsehoods came into there. And somewhere along the way, by that distorted method, they came up with perfect ethical character. Does that seem likely?
No, it doesn't seem likely to me. In my mind, it's sort of the idea of this is the sort of thing that you'd expect to have were it true.
That's the other option, isn't it? Either Jesus was that good, or some people, this non-community of cognitive dysfunction, were the only people in all history to invent someone that good. And you think of the backstory, too. The backstory behind Jesus, if he was really as the Gospels present him to be, is that there is a perfectly good God, a perfectly powerful God, one who cares for us, one who wants to redeem us from our sins. And the story of Jesus, the account of Jesus, really fits into that really well. The backstory of the legend theory is that a bunch of rum-dums trying to salvage their psychological selves came up with this perfect character of Jesus, and it doesn't fit in that backstory very well at all. So to me, the explanation that makes the most sense is the one that fits in, which is that Jesus really was the Son of God.
Well, one more thing, Tom, about this. It comes back to C.S. Lewis's trilemma, liar, lunatic, or Lord. In your estimation, if someone proposed the fourth option, legend, to C.S. Lewis, what would his response have been?
His whole apologetic is would really speak to that. And so his whole understanding of Christianity, that it is the light by which we see, that it is the explanation for the joy, the desire joy that he felt, that he spoke of in his autobiography, that it explains pain, it explains what it means to be human, as he spoke of in The Abolition of Man, it explains miracles. I think he would just say that there isn't any good reason to believe the legend theory, and there's plenty of good reason to believe that it's a true account. But I don't know that he ever addressed legend theorists per se.
Yeah. Well, Tom, I want to point people to the full argument there on Touchstone Magazine's website. So I'll point people back to Apologetics 315 where they can find that link. Now, Tom, again, if people want to find out more of your writing online, they can find it at thinkingchristian.net and also rashiachristi.org. Are there any other resources you'd like to point them to while they're there?
Well, I do write a monthly column for Breakpoint at breakpoint.org. It's a worldview column. But, and by the way, just a bit of a teaser, Carson Whitenauer and I are in the very early stages of planning a follow-on book to True Reason on another topic that will be equally as timely. But I'm just going to leave that as a teaser on that one. We are going to be looking for some really high-quality authors to work with us on it. But, yeah, thinkingchristian.net is where you'll find most of what I'm doing online.
Well, excellent. Tom, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you again. Looking forward to the new projects ahead and hearing another good report down the line. So thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
And thank you too, Brian. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
I've been speaking with Tom Gilson, National Field Director for Ratio Christi. Find links to his resources, the book True Reason, and links to Ratio Christi at today's blog post at Apologetics 315. If you've enjoyed the interview, please share it with a friend via Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/apologetics315 and on Twitter at twitter.com/apologetics315. Please help us get the word out about good apologetics resources. I want to remind those who'd like to support Apologetics 315 that you can do so by using our Amazon affiliate links located at the right-hand side of apologetics315.com. When you do your normal shopping from Amazon, using those links allows a small portion of your purchase to support what we're doing, and it only costs you a click. Those links can also be bookmarked for ease of use whenever you shop online. We continue to transcribe these interviews with the help of volunteer transcribers. If you'd like to help with more, just email me at interviews@apologetics315.com. And if you have suggestions for the interviews, you can email me there as well. This is Brian Auten, and thanks again for listening.